Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. Things will start strange but fun this morning. Then we'll hear about the latest Vermont climate assessment. We'll catch up with one of WDEV's all-stars, Dave Moody, now of the Motor Racing Network. And we'll finish by hearing about the work of the Vermont Community Foundation. But first, that strangeness. Dolls are a popular gift for the holidays, and there's a doll maker in Winooski who creates handmade dolls that are anything but sugar and spice. They may not be for everybody, but those that love them absolutely adore them. Joining us to tell us about the strange dolls is the owner, Beth Robinson. Beth, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, thank you.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Beth about her strange dolls, or if you're already a fan, you can give us a call at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. The email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Beth, I would describe them this way. If my mom's doll collection was invited over to Tim Burton's house for the weekend, this is what they'd look like when they came home on Monday. How do you describe your strange dolls?
Well, I think your assessment is excellent. I see them as a little more tortured. but I like your idea.
A little more tortured than a weekend at Tim Burton's house. Now, when did you start? And I think you're probably right. When did you start making the strange dolls and why?
I started making them in 2003, and a friend sent me some photos of an art installation in Japan that was all handmade dolls by Japanese artists. And it was the first time that I'd ever seen, number one, dolls treated as an art form, as sculpture. And also the environments that they created for these dolls was particularly nightmarish and surreal and very attractive to me and my aesthetic sensibility. So I immediately had to learn how to learn how to make dolls. And at the time, I went to, Borders Bookstore and went to the craft section and tried to find books about doll making, which you can imagine what, you know, the limited selection was like,
sure.
You know, geared towards a certain type of craft. But I did find a series of books by author Susanna Orion about art dolls and how to make art dolls. And I bought the whole series of books, and I learned about polymer clay, which is a very accessible clay. You can bake it in your oven at home. You don't need a kiln. And because of that accessibility, I think it really started off this passion for doll making that hasn't stopped.
Wow. Did you have another career before you started making strange dolls, or is this like the wonderful only entry on your resume?
Well, I mean, I'm an artist in general, so
okay.
So prior to doll making, I was an oil painter and also an illustrator, but the work that I was doing was completely 2D. I had never worked mm-hmm. with clay before. I had never worked with sculpture before. So it was a whole new world for me to work in three dimensions instead of two.
And why the switch? I mean, your friend, you know, had this feeling that this would be something you would really take to, but you had never done sculpture before. So, you know, why did you take to it?
Well, So when I was doing a more 2D work, a lot of the subject matter was dark in nature, and it was a lot of character portraits. And going to clay seemed like an opportunity to take the characters off of canvas and turn them into something more tangible that you could interact with and touch and move around and, have them sort of perform for you, which I found completely delightful. It added a layer of engagement that was really exciting to me. And that's something that I really love now about seeing people interact with my strange dolls, is that there is an interaction and people bring their own story to it and have sort of an immediate desire to want to touch them and want to play with them and want to look at their clothes and touch their hair. And I just love that.
Yeah.
It's something you can't get from a painting.
I'm going to give people your website address right now so they can, you know, see them, so they don't have to conjure the ideas quite as much with their imagination. Strangedolls.net is where you can go to and see Beth's beautiful creations. Where do the ideas come from for the dolls, Beth?
Well, I think it's a mixture of two things. One is serendipity, and the second is from objects, found objects that I find appealing. So, for example, there's a doll I made last year, the year before, that was made from artichoke leaves. She's sort of a crown around her head. And I just found these artichoke leaves really beautiful, and I was inspired by them. So I wanted to incorporate them into a doll. Or it could be something like, people tend to give me a lot of unusual things. So, like
imagine that, Beth.
Yeah, I know. There's some really odd things that show up at my studio. That's for sure. From, you know, bones to cat whiskers to, you know, unusual, pieces of coral or fabric. And so I'm excited by those objects, and they sort of get the juices going, and I get excited about working a piece around that particular object.
Now, for those who haven't gone to the website yet, can you describe one of your favorite dolls for us?
Let's see, one of my favorite dolls. Well, one is very I love all of them.
Sure.
Dearly, like they're my children. One of
very
the most
strange children,
dolls,
but yes, children.
My poor, sad, tortured little strange children. They're all very beautiful in their own way.
True.
They're very special. One of my most popular designs is a character called Dr. Scott, and his head is actually a great horned owl skull. And he has very long, thin limbs, and he's dressed in a black suit, and he has sort of a black top hat. And he was actually one of the original strange doll creations that I made, and he's been so popular ever since. And particularly now during COVID, I think he sort of takes on kind of a different life, as people see him as something of a plague doctor. Good doctor or bad doctor, I'm not sure. That's for you to decide. But his name is Dr. Scopps.
Yeah, he is really charming. Now, we should mention that you took those books back in 2003, and you make these dolls from scratch, I mean, by hand. So explain how you do that, how you go about hand-making a doll.
So they literally start with a brick of clay, a brick of polymer clay, and a wire armature. So the armature is what they're built upon. So there's a wire armature that I create in the size and shape of a doll, and then I apply the clay on top of that. And then once the clay has been cured, then I start designing the clothing for it. So, and again, that also depends upon what fabrics I have available or what fabrics I find interesting, that I'll fashion their clothing and sew the clothing for the doll.
Where does that clothing, the material, come from for the clothing?
I've had, again, wonderful people giving me wonderful gifts. I've got quite a collection of linens that have come from various everyone's grandmothers. So I've got these great antique linens that I work with, and sometimes I'll stain them to make them look a little more antique or old. Mm-hmm. I've also got a good, you know, collection of like fur-like material and leather-like material that I collect along the way. A place that I absolutely love are any scrap bins in fabric stores where they put all the discarded fabrics that no one wants to buy. Those are my favorite places to
There's a big arrow over that says Beth right here.
That's right. When I walk in the door, they say, it's back there.
Yeah,
in the corner.
It is. That's where it is. Any of those grandmothers ever get to see how their old dresses wind up on a strange doll?
I've had one or two, and actually you'd be surprised how delighted they are with what happens. It's sort of funny, your depiction at the beginning of the interview of this sort of party. You know, a lot of these linens that I receive have stories of that, of, you know, they've been used for get-togethers and dinners and tea parties and things like that. And I love the fact that those fabrics come with such a story of people communing together, particularly women, over cups of tea or coffee, and the people who gave them to me are just delighted with how they are turned into dresses and cloaks and skirts and clothing.
Yeah. We're playing with dolls this morning on Vermont Viewpoint, but they are admittedly strange in so many ways. Listeners, you can join the discussion by calling us 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. If you've got that one person on your gift list that you just can't figure out what to get them, and they dress a bit goth, oh, please pay attention. Beth Robinson is the creator of Strange Dolls. She might have exactly what you need. If you'd like to ask Beth about her strange dolls, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255, email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Beth, how long does it take you to make one of these strange dolls?
They can take anywhere from 4 hours to weeks. It depends.
Wow.
I have a doll series, which are 12-inch dolls that I make that are sort of something of a template that I work from. And so they're kind of like rag dolls in a sense. They have a fabric body, and the arms and legs are attached but kind of loose so they can swing. And those dolls take about 4 hours to make. And I've got the series that I have are Day of the Dead dolls, dolls.
Yep.
Corpse paint dolls, bird dolls, and worry dolls.
And then you said some are 12 inches, and then how big are the biggest that you make?
Well, I've experimented with, I've gone all the way up to quite large to I think a 2-foot doll was probably the biggest that I made. And those dolls were actually made for Cirque du Soleil several years ago. They were to be these sort of demented acrobats that were suspended from the ceiling. And they were about 2 feet or 3 feet tall.
Mm. So when someone sees them for the first time, do you know right away whether they get it or not?
Oh, yes. There's a very quick reaction. I have, you know, it usually involves someone walking in the door of my studio and literally stopping and turning around and walking away, or coming right in with their face lit up to say, what is this? You know, what are these creations? These are wonderful. And so, yeah, the studio threshold is the determining factor.
Yeah. So where are strange dolls living around the country or around the world?
Oh, around the world for sure. I just sent one actually off to Norway. I've sent them to Japan and Australia, to Italy. They've just truly traveled the globe. At one point in time, I was trying to put markers on a map of all the places that strange dolls live, and it's really impressive. It's really great. We're so I think artists are so fortunate that we live in a time where we have the internet and we can connect with people all over the globe, no matter where you are. And particularly, you know, during times of COVID, where, you know, accessibility in person is a challenge, you know, thank goodness for the internet, so that, you know, almost anyone in the world is just an email away.
Do you have people who can't wait for your next creation?
I have a great group of collectors that have been following my work pretty much since I started, and they love to see all the iterations because, as you can imagine, over the years, my craft has changed and become more refined, and I'll go through different phases or work with different themes for a while. And so the feedback is always so nice from those collectors that are really familiar with all the different iterations that they've seen of Strange Dolls and how excited they are about the new series or the new dolls that are coming out.
Do you ever custom make any dolls for people?
I used to do a lot of custom work. I don't anymore because I'm so busy filling doll orders that I just don't have the time for it. But I have worked with customers and done custom orders like that in the past and have gotten some really interesting, unusual requests over the years. I've worked with the most interesting commission that I got was that someone sent me their kidney stone, their dog's teeth, and some of their hair to make a doll from.
And you did. You thought that, I can do this.
Yes, I did. I was really excited to have such unusual items and such personal items to work with. The woman who commissioned the piece, she has a mole on her cheek, so the kidney stone was used on the doll as the mole on her cheek.
Oh, brilliant. Do you use materials that are positively human like that often?
From time to time, I would say. It depends on availability. If you have your wisdom teeth that you would like to donate to Strange Dolls, I'm sure there'll be a tooth doll in the future. It really depends on the items that land in my studio. But I've worked with a lot of people's hair. Dog teeth has been a popular one, cat whiskers. And then again, like we had talked about before, with, you know, linens and fabrics that come from families.
Other people get memos in their inbox, but not Beth Robinson. She gets found items that are most peculiar from friends and followers. All right, now you've mentioned a few things. You've mentioned these dolls as being art, and you've mentioned them going around the world, and you've had exhibitions of your dolls. So where have they been shown?
They've also been shown around the world. I was shown in Australia and in Japan. There was actually a mall, I guess you can call it, for lack of a better word, in Japan, where they actually set up a Beth Robinson gallery for a little while.
Wow.
That was very cool. And I'm trying to think, Amsterdam. Australia has been a big one. I've shown several times in Australia before.
Czech Republic recently, I think. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. And Berlin, Germany.
Yeah. But they are for sale. So how much would, say, an accident doll go for?
The accident dolls are $150.
Oh, that's quite reasonable for an accident doll. And they are beautiful pieces. Have your dolls ever made it into a movie? Because if not, they should.
Well, they have, actually, but as sort of background characters in the movie Now You See Me. There's a scene, it's about bank robbers and a bank heist, but there is a scene in a New Orleans voodoo shop where they bought several of my dolls that kind of are all displayed in a row sort of in the background. The scene lasts for probably 20 seconds, but, you know, If you're looking out for it, they're there.
The best 20 seconds of Now You See Me is right then, that scene. So, you know, people who do jobs, especially if they kind of do them repeatedly, tend to have dreams or nightmares of that, you know, activity. So do your strange dolls wind up in your dreams or nightmares?
Well, I think that what I love so much about being an artist and the work that I create is I feel like they're sort of the repository of all of that fantasy. So I feel like I get a lot of the things that are bouncing around in my head that might torment me at night while I'm sleeping. And, you know, those ideas and visuals kind of go into the work that I'm making. So I have quite pleasant dreams, actually. I enjoy my nighttime.
I can just imagine what it's like. You wake up and say, oh my gosh, I had this great nightmare last night. I can't wait to get to the studio. I've got to create a new doll.
I guess you could say that the ideas for my dolls come from more daydreams than night dreams.
Now, in addition to the dolls, what are some other things that you do create?
So in addition to the dolls, I also have a line of jewelry that I do. I make pendants and brooches that have Day of the Dead, their faces with Day of the Dead painting on them. I also make pin cushions, which has been really popular. I originally made one for myself because I needed a pin cushion and thought, I've got the dolls I make have a clay head and a fabric body. Like, you know, I'm most of the way there. And so I started making them, and people would see it in my studio and were interested in it. So I've started making a line of those, and I use remnant fabrics from my studio for the cloth for them. But yeah, those have been really popular. And then there's some magnets that I make as well. So make a mold of it and cast it in resin, so it's really durable.
Where's the studio, and can people come by?
People cannot come by at this time.
Okay.
For COVID, I actually moved my studio at home, so
right.
I haven't ventured out into the public again. So I have my studio at home, but however, I'm always alive online. I've got social media. I'm on Instagram and Facebook, and of course my website is where my shop is, and a full portfolio of things that I've made over the years.
All right. Beth Robinson, creator of Strange Dolls, the website address, strangedolls.net. Beth, thank you so much for sharing your dolls with us this morning. It was a lot of fun.
Well, thanks so much, Rick. I really appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
For a stress-free holiday shopping experience, head to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. Specialty coffee drinks, artisan soups and sandwiches to warm your soul and fill your belly. Grab-and-go meals, local beers, international wines. Upstairs, find a curated collection of unique finds from clothing and accessories to toys, games, and puzzles, candles, cards, snow globes, and so much more. Always free gift wrapping and excellent customer service. So enjoy your holiday shopping. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Back in 2014, there was a Gunda Institute study in Vermont that was the first in the United States to examine climate change at a state level. That was recently updated, and joining us now with the results from the recent study is the lead author of the report. Jillian Galford is also a climate scientist at UVM. Jillian, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you've got questions for Jillian, you can give us a call at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255, or you can email them to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Jillian, what areas does the Vermont Climate Assessment look at?
Well, you know, we really try and cover all sectors that are important to Vermonters. So it's quite a wide range. There's a long list. So everything from how climate is actually changing in Vermont to its impacts on forests, water, fish and wildlife, agriculture, energy, recreation, tourism, health, communities and development, and including our infrastructure. And we took a little dive into soil carbon specifically as well.
How long?
A wide range.
Yeah. How long had you been collecting the data, and how do you go about collecting the data for this report?
Great question. So we relied on a lot of existing data sources, so data that are publicly available. For example, the National Weather Service collects weather data all over the state of Vermont. And one important thing to think about is that weather is kind of what we experience day to day, and climate is what we expect. So in November, we might expect it to be cold. We might expect it to be snowy. But occasionally we have really weird weather, like in January we'll have a really warm day. Mm-hmm. So these stations are all around Vermont collecting weather, the day-to-day observations, and then we do the analysis of climate, which is the long-term trends, or sort of what is happening season to season, decade to decade. So data like that is publicly available, and what we did was we made sure that we were using it in really solid ways. So, for example, weather stations move around. The Burlington Station, this is an interesting historical fact, the Burlington Station used to be down at Burlington Bay, and then it was moved to UVM, and in about the 1940s, it was moved out to the airport. Hmm. So, in fact, we can't compare data from Burlington Bay to the Burlington Airport. That is not actually a continuous record. So we have to do a lot of work to make sure that the data we're using is solid and credible. So we're using all publicly available data. So sources like the National Weather Service, as well as state agencies, researchers around the state, even private organizations that have put information up on their website, like ice out dates.
Right. So, as I mentioned, this was the first, back in 2014, the first in the United States to examine climate change at a state level. What is the benefit to have a climate assessment for an area that is as small as Vermont compared to, you know, anything on the rest of the planet?
Sure. Back in 2014, we developed a framework for the Vermont climate assessment, and we took this sector-by-sector approach. So we were the first ones to really use the same approach that we use on the national scale. On the national scale, the climate assessment, the national climate assessment is meant to inform the president and Congress, but it's actually come to be much more useful as the definitive resource on climate change in the United States. But what happens is in Vermont, we get that national climate assessment, and it's really hard to interpret what it means specifically for Vermont. So we know, for example, from the National Climate Assessment that precipitation is increasing around New England, but if you look at the National Climate Assessment, it doesn't give you much granularity on what's actually happening within Vermont. So the role of the Vermont Climate Assessment is to bring things down to even more of a local level as much as possible, which is really hard. We don't have information on every small town in Vermont, but we can start to get a sense of what's really happening within Vermont, what are the seasonal trends within Vermont, what are the impacts on important sectors to Vermont, and even some of the geographical differences we experience within Vermont. So the idea is that to make actionable decisions, changes in management, changes in policy, we as Vermonters need information that resonates with what we're seeing, you know, in our backyards, out our office windows.
How has Vermont's climate been changing? What have you found in that regard?
So in that regard, Vermont overall is getting warmer and wetter. One thing we talked about in 2014 is that, you know, in 2014 we had just come out of Tropical Storm Irene. We'd been experiencing a lot of precipitation. Precipitation had clearly been increasing. And in 2014, we were very focused on that, too much water. But we also cautioned that there may be times of too little water. And if you look over the last several years, or think about your personal experiences over the last few years, you may recall that the last few years have indeed brought many dry spells. This summer on the radio, you kept hearing, you know, this percent of Vermont is in a drought. So we're really seeing this variability. We're seeing years, summers, where we have too much water, and then other periods where we have not enough water. So that variability, I think, is a really strong theme with the overall trend of getting warmer and getting wetter.
And from the data, what can we expect looking forward, looking into the future?
Sure. I think that's where the Vermont climate assessment is really helpful. Most of the time as scientists, these big scientific reports look out 100 years, and we do include information on that 100-year trajectory out to 2100 in the report. But I think what's really useful for us in our day-to-day lives is thinking about what the next decade or two decades will hold. What is Vermont going to look like in 2030 or 2040? So these recent changes, changes that we've seen over the last decade, two decades, three decades, are a pretty good predictor of where we are headed in the next 10, 20, 30 years. So that is increasing precipitation, increasing temperatures.
Now, how does this type of increase in average temperature that you've found in the data affect our wildlife, for instance?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And there's so many different ways to think about that, from food resources for wildlife to physiological needs of wildlife. Are you interested in birds? Are you interested in mammals? Are you interested in, fish? Maybe you enjoy fishing. So there's lots of different ways, from changes in water temperature to changes in the food chain, and so on. I think one of the most interesting things was some work that was done by the Audubon Society that we profiled in the report. And they looked at different climate change scenarios and specifically how it would impact bird species in Vermont. And I think most Vermonters would be somewhat shocked at the potentially profound impact climate change will have on birds. The loon is very near and dear to my heart. And the common loon is actually expected under various climate change scenarios to not have suitable habitat because of warming temperatures by 2050 or 2070. And that's within our lifetime. It really makes it very real.
Oh, I don't want to lose the loon. I'm with you on that. Another thing you looked at is the effect on our forest land. So what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so forests are all of these impacts of climate change are really complex because there's so many interactions. So on one hand, when it gets warmer and when there's more CO2, carbon dioxide, in the atmosphere, our forests may grow a little bit more. They may help us take some carbon out of the atmosphere. But we expect that other impacts of climate change will outweigh the benefits of climate change on our forests. So in particular, things like deer are expected to increase in population as they will have higher survival rates under climate change. And too many deer can actually do incredible damage to our forests. And they would really be out of balance with our forests and pose a very large threat there.
Are there certain trees, species that we might lose, coming into Vermont because of climate change?
Yeah, there's been a lot of work done on what, how will tree species perhaps change their approaches to reproduction? How might they migrate, literally move to places they weren't before, or change their habitat range? And we go into those by different species types in the report. But certainly things like oak.
You're killing me with the loss of maple and loons, Jillian. Jillian Galford is the lead author of the recent Vermont Climate Assessment, and she's with us until 10 o'clock. Listeners, you can join the conversation by giving us a call, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. That's 877-291-TALK is our toll-free number, or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. We're discussing the results of the recent Vermont Climate Assessment. Lead author Jillian Galford is with me sharing the results. If you've got a question or comment for Jillian, our numbers are 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Now, Jillian, one of your findings could be used for betting purposes, that being the change in the ice out date on Joe's Pond. And it has changed quite a bit, hasn't it, from 1988 to present?
Yes, it's gotten much earlier.
And what does that signal about Vermont's future?
Well, if you look at Joe's Pond, it's a really interesting example because it's not going to help you for betting purposes per se.
Darn it.
Because year to year, there's a lot of variability. And as you know, if you follow Joe's Pond, sometimes the ice goes out at 2 a.m., sometimes it goes out at 8 a.m., 4 p.m. So I'm not going to be able to help you nail it down on that end. But if you look at the trend over the last, several decades where they've been keeping data, keeping records, it's clearly moving earlier in the winter. And, it's not included in the report, but I once played around with some data to try and see what best predicts ice out. Is it the winter temperature? Is it the early springtime temperatures? And they both have a very strong effect. So it's a really clear signal, an easy to understand indicator of our winters getting warmer.
What industries will be affected by this continued trend?
I would say that it's hard to think of any industry that isn't impacted. Every business is going to be thinking about, where they're getting energy, how they're consuming energy. But certainly in Vermont, we think a lot about big economic sectors. And those would be things like our agriculture, our rural livelihoods, as well as recreation and tourism.
And what about farming? What do we think our farmers will see?
So farmers are constantly adapting to conditions. It is a part of farming. So farmers are used to making those changes, but it doesn't mean that they're easy to make changes. We see farmers in Vermont have already begun to adapt to climate change by changing their management practices, so changing the ways that they maybe till the soil or certain cover crops they plant to reduce erosion and things like that.
Now, what have you found out about weather events, such as what we saw with Tropical Storm Irene? And, how does climate change affect those weather events?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. So we talk about these trends, like we're experiencing increasing precipitation, but what does that really mean? It doesn't mean a few extra raindrops every time it rains or a few extra snowflakes every time it snows. What we see is that extra precipitation comes in really big storm events. So in the year of Tropical Storm Irene, we had a really wet spring. So our soils were already very, very saturated, and they just couldn't hold the additional water that Irene brought. So you have big storms that are already bringing a lot more water than they used to, and then you sort of had the final straw was Irene on top of those already wet conditions. So we're seeing those extremes a lot more. There was, a lot of towns and parts of Vermont have been upgrading infrastructure, like culverts under roads after their experiences in Tropical Storm Irene. And I know this summer we had some record-setting precipitation events that actually washed out rather new culverts, that they were even bigger than we had planned or upgraded and expected for.
So has the increase in average temperature been evenly distributed across all the seasons?
It has not been distributed across all the seasons. Precipitation is interesting because it's increasing across most of the seasons. But temperature is a little bit more uneven. So, for example, we see more rapid increases in winter temperature. So winters are warming faster than other parts of the year, which if you're a lover of snow and ice sports, ice fishing or snowmobiling, skiing, that might be particularly worrisome for you. One thing that's interesting, though, is that precipitation has also been consistently increasing in winter. Probably the most consistent increase in precipitation is in winter, which means that we may be better positioned to adapt with practices like snowmaking to maintain trails. Snowmaking is not a perfect solution to warmer conditions, but it does serve as sort of a one way to maintain those winter activities.
Hmm. The report's been out for a couple weeks now, Jillian. What kind of reaction have you been receiving to your findings?
Yeah, so you may have heard that this week the Vermont Climate Council approved the state's climate action plan.
Yesterday, as a matter of fact.
And the Vermont Climate Assessment was referenced a lot as a science resource on the impacts and trends in climate change in Vermont. So in that regard, we're already having a big impact on how people are making decisions around the state.
Now, how do you hope, other than that, the findings will be used?
Yeah, what I hope is that people who know about climate change are empowered to do something about it. So before we started the Vermont Climate Assessment, I was hearing from folks like at regional planning commissions that they knew climate change was happening, they knew things were happening, but they didn't really have enough information to understand what it was doing in their town, in their county, in their community. So with the Vermont Climate Assessment, we hope that people will feel more confident in understanding and acting on climate change at local levels, and that includes from the town level all the way up to the state level. Individual decisions people may make, say, on their farms, all the way to farm policy made in the Vermont State House.
The original report was conducted in 2014. Are we getting to a point where these reports might need to be done, updated more regularly than every 7 years?
You read my mind, Rick. We certainly would like to be putting this information out more frequently. And, in fact, the Climate Action Plan does call for this type of information to support state policy.
And, you know, it's not all doom and gloom. You know, what is the silver lining, or what are silver linings we can glean from the assessment?
Yeah, it certainly is not all doom and gloom. And I was going to bring that up if you didn't. So really interesting things are happening all around Vermont as people adapt to climate change. I love seeing what's happening in the farming and agriculture sector. People are experimenting with new crops that literally were not viable in Vermont 2 decades ago. You know, we've seen wine varietals go in. People are planting saffron now in Vermont. But even, you know, more common things like watermelon and so on, we're seeing an extended growing season. So there's definitely more risks for many of these producers, but there's also more opportunities. I want to emphasize, too, there was a lot of work in the climate assessment on how people are able to adapt to climate change, and things like traditional systems of seed saving are sort of having a renaissance. People are recognizing how important it is to go back and look at old seed varietals that maybe had been lost or neglected as more, you know, commercial seeds had come online. So a lot of knowledge and social systems are a really important part to building resilience, particularly in our food systems.
Jillian Galford is a climate scientist at UVM, the lead author of the Vermont Climate Assessment, and you can find the full report at vtclimate.org. Jillian, thank you so much for being on the show this morning.
Thanks for having me.
All right, take care. It's been a treat getting to celebrate WDEV's 90th anniversary, and even more so, getting to hear the stories of the WDEV All-Stars who have played such an important role in the station's history. My next guest has ridden the career track from calling the Milk Bowl at Thunder Road all the way to the Motor Racing Network. He's also the host of Sirius XM Speedway, and he joins us now. Dave Moody, thanks for joining us this morning on Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning, Rick. Good to be here. Thank you.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Dave about his career, or if you've got a racing question, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
For a stress-free holiday shopping experience, head to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. Specialty coffee drinks, artisan soups and sandwiches to warm your soul and fill your belly. Grab-and-go meals, local beers, international wines. Upstairs, find a curated collection of unique finds from clothing and accessories to toys, games, and puzzles. Candles, cards, snow globes, and so much more. Always free gift wrapping and excellent customer service. So enjoy your holiday shopping. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Dave, when were you first exposed to racing at Thunder Road?
I was 5 years old. Wow. My uncle, Doug McDonald, lived in Rumney, New Hampshire, about a 90-minute drive away, and was a rabid fan of stock car racing, and particularly Thunder Road. And he would make the three-hour round-trip drive, certainly for the weekend races and for a lot of the Thursday nighters, too. And when I got to be about, 5 years old, my family lived in Montpelier, and at some point it occurred to him that he had a perfectly serviceable nephew just a few miles up the road from the racetrack. Maybe he ought to bring me along. And the first time he did, I fell in love with racing, and it's I've done a lot of different things over the years, particularly working for Ken at WDEV. You had to be multifunctional at DEV, and you still do today, but the racing thing fit me like nothing else ever did. So from 5 years on, my path has been chosen.
Well, but did you ever think at that point that you'd eventually become the track announcer there, wind up what you're doing today?
I never did. I mean, that was never a plan. I don't know that I ever had a plan, quite honestly, but if I did, it certainly wasn't that. All I knew as a kid was that Thursday night was the most important time of the week. And if on Tuesday the weather forecast was for rain on Thursday, man, I was panicked. I mean, I was just depressed and panicked because Thursday night had to happen at the nation's site of excitement. And I'm still kind of that way today. You know, there's nothing worse than rain at the racetrack still today.
Yeah, absolutely. So how did Ken Squire pick you to fill in for him at Thunder Road?
I really wish I knew. There came a point when Ken started getting very busy with CBS,
right,
traveling around the country and around the world, and could not always be at Thunder Road and on the public address system. At that point in time, it was like the summer before my senior year in high school, and I had started writing a column for the old Speedway Scene weekly racing trade paper. And I like to think that Ken read a couple of my columns and said, okay, here's a kid that really loves the sport. He really loves Thunder Road. He's got a workable vocabulary. Maybe I could teach him how to do it. In all likelihood, though, he probably just saw me standing there with my finger in my nose and said, there's a kid with time on his hands. I don't know which one it was, but either way, it worked out great.
What was it the first time? What was it like that first time you got behind the mic and did the call at Thunder Road?
Well, he eased me in really gradually.
Uh-huh.
At first, he would say, go up there during practice, before the races actually start,
nice,
and tell people where the concession stands and the restrooms are, and don't screw anything else. Don't do anything else because you'll probably screw it up. And over time, he would give me a little more to do. Over the course of that first year, he'd give me, okay, we're going to let you do the street stock heats tonight. We're going to let you do Victory Lane tonight. And every Thursday night, I would do whatever it was that he asked me to do, allowed me to do. And then on Friday morning, I would be in his office at WDEV, and he would, and as you well know, Ken has never been and never will be a glad hander. He's
right,
going to tell you what you did wrong,
yep,
and probably in no uncertain terms. And one of the things that I am most thankful for in my life, that as a know-it-all 17- or 18-year-old kid back then, I was smart enough to know that if I just checked my ego at the door and took his constructive criticism for what it was, constructive,
yep,
I could learn a lot from Ken Squire, and boy, did I over the years.
What a mentorship. That is fantastic. You mentioned the different roles you had to play at DEV, so what were some of the other things you did here during that time?
Oh, good Lord. I mean, I was the sports director at DEV for a number of years. That's a really fancy term for, broadcasting somewhere between 85 and 120 high school basketball games a year. Norwich Hockey, along with my dear friend George Como. We were the first ones on the ground to do that and kind of establish the Norwich Hockey franchise as a viable on-air commodity. Rick, I did everything. Probably the highlight or the low light, I'm not sure which, of my broadcasting career at WDEV, for many years, 5 or 6 years running, we broadcast the Vermont State Snowplow and Backhoe Championships live from the parking lot at the Barry Auditorium. Now, I don't think there's anybody else on planet Earth that has ever broadcast a backhoe and snowplow championship, but I did.
That is gold. And I think for that reason, Dave, you're still listed as Sports Director Emeritus here at WDEV, a title you well earned. So, do you give us maybe just a little bit of a basketball call? I'm going to say Spalding versus Montpelier. A little throwback. Can you give us, 10 seconds worth of a basketball call of what it would sound like years ago on WDEV?
You know, we had so many great games and great calls over the year. You know, the Spalding-Montpelier rivalry, I grew up in that because I went to Montpelier High. You know, back in the day where you didn't even associate with those Spalding kids. I mean, you know, one of my buddies in high school actually dated a girl from Spalding one time, took her out one time. And when the guys on the football team and I, when we found out about it, that came to a crashing end. And he was informed in no uncertain terms, if you want to continue to play ball for us, with us, you're going to have to dump that girl. And, you know, it was no different. People's Academy against Lamoille Union. It didn't matter, man. There were just some great rivalries back then. And, you know, it's been a long time since I called a basketball game. I've been here in the South now for 11 or 12 years. And I probably stopped doing that for Ken a year or two before I moved. But, man, did we have some great times back then. No. I even broadcast a high school basketball game that had a halftime parade.
What was that? What was that all about?
Well, it wasn't planned. We were doing a People's Academy Lamoille Union game at PA. And it was one of those early spring deals where you get a little bit of a thaw, and instead of snowing, it rains. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those deals where the roof of the People's Academy Gymnasium had kind of an ice dam built up from a long winter. And then when it rained, the water pooled on the roof. And about halfway through the second quarter, we ended up getting a small puddle forming at about center court, which obviously was not safe.
Right.
The referees waved it off and said, okay, everybody, after consultation with the athletic director at both schools, said, okay, everybody, here's what we're going to do. Go out to your cars. We're all going to go to Lamoille. We're going to pick up the game where it stands right now. We're just going to take it across town to Lamoille Union. So we packed up our stuff. I packed up my microphones and my equipment. We drove the 10 or 11 miles to Lamoille Union. We called it the halftime parade. And we just resumed a few miles up the road. Never seen anything like that happen.
Oh, Dave, that is radio gold. I'm imagining the board op here back at the station thinking, what do I do for the next hour, 45 minutes, till they get set up over at Lamoille? Oh, that's incredible.
I don't know what he did, but I know he did something. It may have been Lee Cattell at that point.
Uh-huh.
You know, Lee's been around a long time. If it wasn't Lee, it was probably Todd LeBaron or somebody like that. But all I said was, listen, dude, it's going to be a few minutes. We got to go across town and get everything set up, but I'll let you know when we're ready to go again.
Oh, I love it. Now, can we put out the call for you again to take a step up in class? When was that?
Well, if you're talking about the MRN deal, that was probably 83 or 84. And again, I don't know why it happened. All I know is that every door that's ever opened for me in the business from day one in the broadcast business, Ken either held the door open or kicked the door open for me. Mm. And quite honestly, it wasn't in his best interest to do that, because he probably would have been much better off if I had stayed in Vermont, stayed at WDEV, kept doing the high school basketball and the Norwich hockey and the Vermont State Snowplow and Backhoe Championships, because, you know, we made a lot of money. We had some basketball games that we had to do an hour pregame show and a 45-minute postgame show just because we couldn't cram all the commercials in. So it would have been in Ken's best interest to keep me there, you know, kind of under his wing and working for him. But he never did. He always said, if you have an opportunity to move up, if you have an opportunity to better yourself and expand your career, I'm going to help you any way I can. And I've never forgotten that. Never will.
Beautiful. Let's take a call. We've got Dick joining us from Waterbury. Hi, Dick.
Hi, good morning. Hi, Dave. How are you?
I'm well, my friend. How are you?
Good, good. Hey, I remember from years ago when you and George did the Norwich hockey games. Those games were so enjoyable to listen to. I would even say you two were on a par with Jerry Remy and Don Ercilio.
Oh, wow.
As far as the chemistry that...
Thank you for that. That's very kind. We had a blast back then. And I remember the day when Ken came to us and said, we're going to do Norwich hockey this year. And I was not completely sold on the concept because, you know, for many years, Norwich had played their hockey games in a barely converted cavalry barn.
Right.
And I didn't know at that time that they were getting ready to build Kreitzberg Arena, which was then and certainly is now a showplace for college hockey at that level. And Ken said, listen, we're going to do this, and we're going to do it right, so you guys get to work and figure out how we're going to do it. And we were so fortunate because Norwich had decided that they were going to upgrade their hockey program, and they brought in Mike McShane as coach. And in a very short period of time, like maybe year two or three, they were winning national championships. And we were traveling to Wisconsin to cover Norwich out there playing, you know, Wisconsin Superior and St. Thomas for the Division III national championship. We were sure in the right place at the right time on that. And, you know, George Como is just a phenomenal talent.
Yeah.
He's as good, you know, I listen to NHL games on the radio with some frequency because I'm a huge hockey fan. George is as good or better than 95% of the guys that are calling hockey in the National Hockey League.
Amen.
And the state of Vermont and WDEV are just so blessed to have had him for all these years.
And hockey is probably the most difficult game to call of any. As part of WDEV's 90th anniversary celebration, we're spending time visiting with the many all-stars of our past. Today we've got Dave Moody with us. And to speak with Dave, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Dave, what was it like the first time you got to work Daytona?
Well, I wasn't smart enough to be scared to death.
Good.
John McMullen, who was running the network at that time, after at least one glowing recommendation from Kenley, called me and said, would you be interested? We'll send you an airplane ticket. We'll give you a hotel room. Would you be interested in coming down to Daytona in February and auditioning for the network? Well, it didn't take me very long to say yes. And that spring, that February, I went to Daytona Beach, and they sent me out to turn two at Daytona with a broadcast kit on, and Dave Despain, who went on to wind tunnel fame and Speed Channel fame and was an amazing broadcaster in his own right. They sent me out there to do a quick audition, which basically we called five or six laps of practice, just kind of to see what you could do. And then after that, they said, okay, why don't you just stay out there and spot for Despain, who's going to call what's now the Xfinity Series. I think it was then Busch Grand National.
Right.
So I stayed out there with Despain and pointed out a couple of things that I saw, and all's well that ends well. Went back the next day and still do, MRN always has a pre-race production meeting. And in the production meeting, John McMullen said, all right, Dave Despain, you'll be out in turn two again. Why don't you take Dave Moody out with you again, and he can spot for you? And Despain raised his hand, and I'll never forget this. And he said, guys, I'm a motorcycle racing guy. Half of the intelligent things that I said yesterday, this kid pointed out to me before I even noticed. Why don't you just send him out to do the race? And everybody looked at me like, oh, my God, we can't send this kid out there to turn two. And to his never-ending credit, McMullen looked at me and he said, are you up for it? And I said, well, yeah, I'll go out there and I'll do the best I can do. And I went out there and I called the race. And I remember very clearly, Harry Gant dominated the race that day and was half the back straightaway ahead at Daytona, which is, you know, the better part of a mile. But as the race went on and we got down to the final 10 or 20% of it, the whole back of his car was covered with oil. And I mentioned during a commercial, guys, keep an eye on Harry because I think he's got a rear end burning out in that thing and he probably won't make it to the finish. Nobody followed up on that. And with about five to go, unbeatable Harry Gant pulls to the garage, They interview him, and he says, yeah, the rear end blew up. I knew it was going. I smelled it 50 laps ago. And we go to the next commercial, and Barney Hall on the microphone, and he meant this, you know, as a compliment. He said, smart A Yankees. Meaning, okay, we didn't listen to the kid. We'll listen to the kid from now on. That was my first outing for MRM, first of many after all these years.
Oh, wow, what a great memory. And Barney Hall, really a great mentor of yours. What did he teach you?
Well, he was phenomenal. And I say that to anyone that asks, and a lot of people that don't, Rick, that I've been very fortunate. I went to Ken Squire High School and Barney Hall University. And Barney taught me a lot about how you do business in that NASCAR garage, because when you're there for a while, you know, and I've been there for a long while now, you earn people's trust, and people tell you things that you may not necessarily, maybe you're not supposed to know, but if they trust you, they'll tell you because they know you're not going to put it on the air and ruin their deal. Barney knew everything in that garage, every driver looking for a ride, every sponsor looking for a new team, every team owner looking for a change. He was the matchmaker of NASCAR because he would put all those people together, and nobody ever knew that he did it. And he said to me once after I'd been with the network 5 or 6 years, he said, I see you in the garage talking to people. People trust you, and they tell you things. He said, you'll be tempted from time to time to talk about it on the air. He said, but if you do, you'll get a 15-second scoop, and nobody will ever trust you again. Mm. Keep doing what you're doing, because that trust is far more important than any scoop you'll ever get. And he was right then, and he's still right today.
Oh, that's a gold nugget. Now, you really know a lot about cars. I mean, there's those who watch races, but, you know, what's your background as far as, you know, the mechanics, or did you ever – your race over at Thunder Road? I apologize for not knowing this.
I am nobody's excuse for a mechanic, that's for sure. I raced very briefly at Thunder Road in the old mini stock division, you know, the Volkswagen Beetles and the like. It didn't take me very long at all, Rick, to figure out that as a racer, I was probably a pretty good writer or announcer. I was not a stock car driver by any means at all. The difference between racers and normal people is that if a racer sees a hole in traffic and it's almost big enough to fit his car in, that's what he does. He fits that car in.
Uh-huh.
Real people look at that hole and say, there's no way in the world I can make it through there. I'm not taking the chance. I was in class two. I was in the group that said, no, I'm not going to try it because I'll probably crash. And that's a sign that you're not a real racer. So I fortunately figured that out very early.
Dave, in addition to MRN, you've been hosting SiriusXM Speedway, I think, for almost two decades now. So, first of all, I think Sirius was probably in its infancy when they, you know, that was first floated. What did you think about it, and how has the show grown in all these years?
You know, it's phenomenal, Rick, because when we started, I figured if we got 2 years out of it, it would be a miracle. But I was willing to give it a try. And part of the reason why I was willing to give it a try is that I had done the exact same show that I do now on WDEV every Monday night for the better part of a decade, starting out with Ernie Farrar and then the late Ernie Farrar, who was so much a part of WBMT for so many years.
Yeah.
And then on my own, we did a show called The Inside Groove on Monday nights, 6 to 7, on WDEV, and the format was virtually identical to what I do on SiriusXM, except we do 4 hours a day instead of 1 hour a week. We'd spend the first half hour talking to the winners of all the races. We'd open up the phone lines for the second half hour and let people call in and say, I love Dave Dion, or I love Bobby Dragon, or I hate Dwayne Lanphier. It didn't really matter back then, and it doesn't matter today, but it was exactly the same show. So I took the challenge, and we went on the air. It's been 18 years now, 18 years just a couple of weeks ago in November. And they dropped us right in the middle of the Stick and Ball Sports Channel, Sirius Sports Action Channel 123. And from 7 o'clock in the morning to 3 o'clock in the afternoon, it was baseball, football, basketball, and hockey. Nothing else. Stick and ball sports. At 3 o'clock, all of a sudden, I'd come on the air and talk about those darn race cars for 3 hours. And then at the end of my shift, we would hand off to a very proper British chap and World Soccer Daily. We didn't hand off one single listener from my show to the next show, but it worked somehow. And here we are 18 years later still doing it.
Oh, congratulations. Is there anything you'd still like to do in your career, especially here at WDEV? Because, like, if it's the dump show or calming the cows on the trading post, you know, we can work you in.
Oh, you know, when you work, as you well know, when you work at WDEV, you got to be able to multitask. And I did, you know, I did a lot of new news updates when yep. Ken was on the road. I think I even did the disc jockey thing for like one shift, one time when Jack Donovan got sick and couldn't do it.
Wow.
That certainly was not my calling. You know, I sold commercials. I, you know, sold advertising. I would print out all the packages for the sports that we could hand out to the sponsors to try and get them on board. I think, though, at the end of it all, I was probably properly placed because whatever skill set I had was pretty well devoted to calling live sports on the air. So I think I'll fall off my perch.
Yeah, I think you got a future in it. Dave, the Godfather Moody, works for the Motor Racing Network and is the host of SiriusXM Speedway, and he is indeed a WDEV All-Star. Dave, thanks so much for being on with us this morning.
Great pleasure, Rick. Best to everybody back home. Thank
all right,
you.
Take care.
For a stress-free holiday shopping experience, head to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. Specialty coffee drinks, artisan soups and sandwiches to warm your soul and fill your belly. Grab-and-go meals, local beers, international wines. Upstairs, find a curated collection of unique finds from clothing and accessories to toys, games, and puzzles, candles, cards, snow globes, and so much more. Always free gift wrapping and excellent customer service. So enjoy your holiday shopping. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
It's been 10 years since Tropical Storm Irene, and a lot of individuals and a lot of organizations stepped up at that time to help in the recovery. I remember distinctly how the Vermont Community Foundation did its part, using its expertise to create a website to coordinate the philanthropic response and to facilitate recovery efforts. VCF created the Vermont Farm Disaster Relief Fund, the Mobile Home Relief Fund, among other specialized giving avenues. In a decade since, they've done so much more to find the needs in our communities and to funnel grants to worthy recipients. Joining us now to give a clearer picture of the work of the Vermont Community Foundation is their president and CEO, Dan Smith. Dan, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick. It's a pleasure to be on the call with you today.
Wonderful to have you. Listeners, to ask Dan about VCF, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Dan, give us a description of what Vermont Community Foundation is.
Well, the Vermont Community Foundation was founded in 1986 to be an enduring source of philanthropy that supports Vermont communities. We support communities with grants directly to nonprofit organizations and investments out of the assets we manage in Vermont communities that advance our mission of community and economic vitality. We help generous Vermonters, philanthropic Vermonters, find and fund the causes they love and make a difference in the place they care about. And they're constantly and incessantly curious about the ways philanthropy can help make a difference in Vermont communities. That means both addressing the urgent and immediate needs of a particular season or a particular year or, you know, a context like the pandemic, but also trying to go to work on the systemic issues that underscore our communities and inform the experience of what it's like to grow up and live in Vermont in the 21st century.
So is the foundation set up to serve people looking to make a donation to benefit the community, or is it there to help organizations that need support and guidance?
Well, it's a little bit of both, Rick. You know, we're composed of roughly 900 different funds, a number of which are connected to families and individuals in funds that are popularly grants that go out to organizations in the communities and to the organizations they care about. We also work closely with the nonprofit sector through our own community grants and investment team to support organizations with our own resources, with our own capacity building efforts, and our own view into the strategies that will make a great difference in Vermont.
So on the donor side, how do you work with someone who wants to make a contribution?
Well, I mean, every donor, every family, everyone's unique. There are a number of different ways you can give, or somebody can give through the Community Foundation. They can open what we refer to as a donor advised fund, which is you've had a good year, you're a realtor, and home sales have been off the charts. You've had a good year, you want to be philanthropic, but your next year may not be the same. So you open a donor advised fund that allows you to stabilize your giving and give out over a period of years. Subsequently, while the assets are managed by the Community Foundation. Other folks give directly into funds that are tied to interests they care about, like the Vermont Women's Fund, which is housed at the Community Foundation, focusing on the economic well-being of Vermont women and girls, or the Samara Fund, focusing on the LGBTQ community in Vermont, or the Curtis Fund, which is part of the Community Foundation and the single largest scholarship grant maker in the state of Vermont. So there are a number of different ways to give through the Community Foundation or work with the Community Foundation and pursue the difference you want to make in support of your neighbors in Vermont.
How many donors do contribute through VCF each year?
Well, in any given year, like I said, we're managing roughly 900 different funds year over year. Last year was 2020 was an incredibly unique year. You referenced Irene, similar to Irene. The pandemic offered one of those moments that we consider the moments for which a community foundation exists. And there were thousands of different gifts into a COVID-19 response fund that we stood up early in the pandemic. So that's thousands of different Vermonters, people connected to Vermont and live out of state, Vermont businesses who gave into a pooled fund to help communities and organizations respond to the circumstances that were unleashed by the pandemic in 2020.
And then, getting these out into the community, these contributions, are they made in the form of grants? Is that how you distribute them?
Yeah, they from the COVID-19 response fund, we made grants directly out into community organizations addressing the urgent needs facing Vermonters. We actually took that from it. It was all grant-making. Direct organizations, we divided the strategy in half, so it was grants to direct service organizations responding to the needs facing Vermonters, food access and insecurity, social isolation, those kinds of things across the state of Vermont and every corner of the state. They also held a portion of the COVID-19 response fund to address the underlying systemic issues that we knew were accelerated by the pandemic. So we looked at things like how we support learners in transition as people revisited their career trajectory, dislocated workers looking for career training, access to telecommunications in the long term, well-being of BIPOC Vermonters through a welcoming and belonging initiative, the food system in the long term, really the ability to pivot our food system onto emergency footing when a crisis like this strikes, and entrepreneurship and rural economic development, understanding that the creation of new enterprises in rural communities is going to be a part of the long-term economic recovery that we need to see.
And, Dan, when we say grants, not being in the philanthropic world, does that mean that there has to be a very specific need or program that the money is given to or for?
Well, it goes into a nonprofit organization, and it's either tied to a particular program in the organization, or it's in operational. It's operational support to the organization. So it can be either. One thing I would call out for listeners is that in this moment, particularly small community-based organizations, first and foremost, Vermonters have been incredibly generous over the course of the last 18 months. You know, if we take one thing away from this pandemic, similar to the response in Hurricane Irene, Tropical Storm Irene, people step up for their neighbors. They find ways to give, whether it's a donation, whether it's volunteering. Vermonters look out for their neighbors, and that's been our experience in the last 18 months. But small organizations, community-based organizations, are feeling the pressure of the economic uncertainty that's out there. They're feeling a ton of pressure. And many of the federal resources that came through the state were hard to access for smaller community-based organizations. So operational support for small organizations, while is incredibly important, so that those organizations that are stepping up for their neighbors, small towns across the state, really have.
Dan, there is something that you've set up that I wouldn't have thought was something that VCF would do, and no offense, but you've set up a mental health and suicide prevention-focused recovery initiative, which is vitally important. So, first of all, what are the details of what it is?
Well, thanks for making that observation. You know, we see as our role to adapt and respond to the changing circumstances that are facing Vermont communities. And it's indisputable right now that the environment of the pandemic and the circumstances that play in Vermont communities are taking a toll in terms of the behavioral and mental health of Vermonters. And there are pressures across the medical and the healthcare system around how to respond to the needs of folks facing those crises. So thank you to the generous Vermonters who've helped us launch this initiative. We're working at both community-based organizations that are supporting Vermonters who are facing behavioral and mental crises, but also working in partnership with emergency rooms across the state, emergency departments and hospitals across the state. So they have some of the tools that are necessary to support particularly youth who are in emergency departments looking for treatment and care as they face acute mental crises. So it is a tragedy that is, I think, unfolding across Vermont communities and requires attention. And like I said, our job is to respond to the changing circumstances as they unfold across Vermont communities and make sure that those who have the skills and knowledge to respond have the resources necessary to do so as best they can.
So, Dan, is it set up as a fund, and then you give grants to specific organizations working in this area? What is the logistics of this?
That's right. It's set up as a fund and with multiple rounds of grants that will go to both organizations and medical centers based on the needs, based on the proposals that we solicit from those organizations in response to the initiative we've launched. So it's a mix of grassroots organizations, community organizations that are supporting those folks facing crises, and as I said, the emergency departments and the hospitals.
Kudos. And where are you in the development of this, Dan?
We've rolled out several different rounds of grants and projects in the launch of the fund. I think we're at about $750,000 of resources that have been raised and deployed. I believe we have another couple of rounds of grants that we'll be able to fund looking out a little further. Again, a project like this is made possible by some incredibly generous Vermonters who've recognized the need and the challenges of suicide prevention and the acute pressures and mental acute pressures on the system that supports Vermonters who are facing behavioral and mental crises. And the acute pressures that are facing Vermonters across communities right now, particularly young people.
What a great example of the synergy that can be created, finding an idea, funneling, energies, and in this case now $750,000 into helping mental health suicide prevention. Dan, do donors to VCF have to be making huge gifts?
The thing is, Rick, Vermonters can step up for each other at any level. They can give through the Women's Fund, or they can give through the VCF funds focusing on the opportunity gap. They can give through the funds focusing on behavioral and mental health. They can give through the Curtis Fund. They can give at any level. And that's, the wonderful thing about the pandemic is that we saw gifts ranging from $5 to seven figures in support of Vermonters, in support of a coordinated and combined strategy to fill the gaps and address the community needs facing Vermonters in the pandemic. And people give in so many different ways. It's not just giving through the foundation. People show up for their neighbors. They volunteer. They help out when, snow needs shoveling. They help stack wood. They help split wood. They donate across our communities. And the thing about the act of giving that I think is so important at any level is that it's something that ties us to each other as a part of our community, right? The strength of our community is only as strong as our neighbors' experience. So the act of giving is a statement and an indication that we're connected to our neighbors' experience in a way that allows us to understand it a little better, that we're committed to it, and we understand that our community is only as strong as that neighbor's experience. And that's a really important thing right now when, you know, we see in so many different ways how divided we are, how we think differently about so many different things. But on a local level, on a, you know, in a community level, we share much more than we don't.
Yeah, it is the Vermont way. You've mentioned a few of these funds, and I'm not going to ask about all 900 that you have set up, but there are a few I'd really like to go a little deeper in. And one is the Vermont Women's Fund. Tell us about that. This is really important.
Well, the Vermont Women's Fund is a wonderful organization. You know, it's a committee-advised fund. There's a group of 10 or so, a committee of 10 or so folks who are come together to deploy several hundred thousand dollars in grant making on an annual basis to support the economic well-being of Vermont women and girls. A key strategy for the Vermont Women's Fund over the last few years has been this Change the Story initiative, which has been about aggregating data about the differential experience of Vermont women and girls economically and in Vermont communities. So policymakers and philanthropy can engage on what we know to be a very disparate experience in terms of lifetime economic security. So Change the Story initiative is a kind of a transformative strategy that the Vermont Women's Fund has helped feed over the course of the last 3 years. Right now, they've launched a really fascinating initiative that is called This Way Up, which is intended to build a database of Vermont based, women-owned businesses based in Vermont, so we can understand the economic experience and trajectory and support the economic experience and trajectory of Vermont female entrepreneurs as they start and launch businesses over time and foster economic security and equity through those kinds of strategies. So, you know, it's a wonderful form of kind of participatory grant-making structure that brings people together to help inform both strategy and then the deployment of philanthropic resources to effectuate an important strategy around gender equity over time.
Nice. Earlier this week, Dan, I had a great organization from the NEK umbrella on with me. You've got the Northeast Kingdom Fund. Tell us about that.
Well, another type of fund that we manage is a place-based fund. So the Northeast Kingdom Fund is similar to the Women's Fund, it's a committee-advised group of folks who come together and deploy grants across in community organizations across the Northeast Kingdom. We've grant-funded Umbrella, and the executive director of Umbrella, Amanda Cochran, is just a wonderfully dynamic leader for the kingdom in support of in the support of women in the Northeast Kingdom. But the Kingdom Fund is, you know, on an annual basis, they come together and run a competitive grant round to support community-based organizations in the kingdom. It's philanthropy of the kingdom, by the kingdom, for the kingdom, and we facilitate those folks who want to come together and make a difference. Another example of, you know, it's a kind of fund that will support Catamount Arts. You know, this most recent round of Kingdom funding supported Catamount Arts for the Open Stage 3.0 project, which is a substance abuse prevention program for youth in the kingdom, after school programs, a number of different ways it shows up in support of the Northeast Kingdom.
There's one more I want to, you've mentioned it kind of quickly, and I found out about it a few years ago, very impressed with the Curtis Fund. Tell people about that.
Well, the Curtis Fund is it's part of the VCF as a what's called a supporting organization, which it falls in our family of funds within its own board of directors. But they deploy roughly $1.6 million of scholarship grant making through a close partnership with the Vermont Student Assistance Corporation. It came from a bequest that somebody's estate, their will left $100,000. 100 years ago that grew over time to be an incredible balance that generates a ton of scholarship money supporting low-income Vermonters pursuing their education and pursuing the skills and knowledge that allow them to be economically secure. In particular, they recently launched a Credential of Value scholarship program, really focusing, expanding their programming beyond traditional degrees into the credentials that are tied directly to high-skill
high wage jobs in Vermont. So really trying to tie people into the ways and the skills and knowledge that allow them to be economically secure. So it's, you know, it's a wonderful piece of philanthropy that shows up for people who are wrestling with how to pay for college, which we know is a challenge in the 21st century.
Yeah, well done. We've got about 45 seconds left. I know one of your goals of the foundation is closing the opportunity gap as concisely as you can. How does VCF do that?
Well, the opportunity gap is sort of the set of conditions that hold Vermonters in place by virtue of where they're from, what racial background they come from, or what their family background comes from. It's important to do that through access to early childhood care and education, access to college and career training, long-term community and economic vitality, so there are jobs that exist in the places in which people live, and support for youth and families during the developing years, so people are not left out and left behind as they're moving through the K-12 system. So we focus a lot of our energy and a lot of our grant making into a framework reflective of those four priorities in hopes that we can build greater equity across the state and foster a sense of potential and opportunity for all Vermonters.
Dan Smith is the president and CEO of the Vermont Community Foundation, and you can learn more about its work at vermontcf.org. Dan, it has been great hearing about the work of VCF this morning. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Rick. It's a pleasure to be on.
All right, keep it up. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan, and feel free to suggest topics by sending them to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. You can listen to past episodes of our podcast at wdevradio.com. You can download it. You can subscribe to it. And the Vermont Viewpoint podcast is sponsored by the Warren Store. Funky, friendly, and almost world famous. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sarah is up next. Tomorrow, I will meet you back here, but I will be broadcasting from the Capstone Community Action in Barrie. Take care.